Okay, so we are at week five now of our VMV, Vision, Mission, Values, Jesus is Our Magic. And today we are talking about unwavering service. We'll be in Mark chapter 10, verses 35 through 45 this morning. So what is a paradox? A paradox is something that when you first encounter it, it doesn't make any sense. It seems contradictory, but then when you look closer at it, you realize that it actually makes sense in a way that you never saw before. When you drop a pencil into a glass of water, how does the pencil look? It looks crooked, right? We all know the pencil's straight, but our eyes, they tell us that it's crooked. When you take God's perfect truth from heaven and you pass it down into this imperfect world and we look at it with our imperfect human eyes, it sometimes can look crooked. It doesn't make sense to us. And very often when Jesus taught, that's how people reacted. It seemed illogical and sometimes even maybe a little offensive. For those who had ears to hear, they realized that what they were hearing was the purest kind of truth. Here's another example of a paradoxical truth. This statement is false. If that sentence is true, and the statement is false, then the sentence is true even as it's false. Don't hurt yourself. I just wanted to have a little fun with you before you get started. Many of Jesus' teachings were paradoxical. Statements like the one I just made. If you want to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. If you want to be strong, you have to become weak. If you want to be first, you have to be last. And today we'll talk about this paradoxical statement. If you want to be truly great, especially as a leader, you have to become a servant. Serving is leading. So let's jump right into the passage, Mark chapter 10, 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? Yes, we can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those whom they have been prepared. When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave to all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So in this paradoxical teaching of Jesus, we see three things. We see the typical way, the better way, and changing our way. So there's the typical way we try to achieve greatness. Jesus introduces then a better way, and then given those two ways, what would it mean to change our way? So first, the typical way. The passage starts out with a conversation between Jesus and two of his disciples. They were brothers, James and John. And did you know that Jesus had actually given these guys a nickname previously to this? He called them the Sons of Thunder. Pretty cool nickname. So apparently these guys were not known for being quiet and passive. If James and John were alive today, I could kind of picture them wearing like leather jackets or something, you know, with like a lightning bolt going down the back and it says Sons of Thunder over the back, you know, riding Harleys or something. That's the way I would see them. But anyway, James and John approached Jesus in private with a request. And I've always been a little struck by the way they introduced this request. Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Just a little bit presumptuous, right? Like, we're going to ask you something, and we need you to tell us that you're going to say yes. which is also kind of funny, but also revealing. It seems like the sons of thunder had a sense of entitlement. It seems like they viewed Jesus as a means to fulfill their wishes. So Jesus says, okay, what do you want me to do for you? And they say, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. You see, they believe that pretty soon God's kingdom will be coming to earth as it is in heaven. And they basically say, Jesus, we know that you're number one in your coming kingdom. We know. But we think that we should be number two and number three. That's all. That's all we're saying. You'll do that, right? And just a side note here, some people say that the Gospels were made up or embellished. So this stuff didn't really happen. And the church just kind of invented these stories as propaganda to advance its agenda. Then why in the world would the church invent a story that makes two of its key apostles look like idiots? Right? I mean, I know what we can do. I know how we can make people believe this story. Let's just say that James and John, they made this power play, you know, for the top positions. And then Jesus, he calls them out, and he calls them out in front of all of their friends. And that'll make Christianity look great, won't it? The Gospels are so raw and unflattering at times. And to me, it just makes them even more believable. So here's my question. What would drive somebody to make a request like James and John did? And the answer is look in the mirror. Because we are human, just like James and John were. And as humans, we're naturally self-absorbed and self-promoting and at the same time, self-doubting. In other words, we think a lot of ourselves. And when it comes to relating to other people, that self-focus tends to come out in two main ways: competition and domination. So first, there's competition. In the previous chapter, Mark 9, it says the disciples, they were arguing about who was the greatest. Can you imagine that scene? You've got, you know, I can just picture Matthew going, you know, look, guys, all I'm saying, just saying that I was a chief tax collector, and I was bringing in the dough. And I gave all that up to follow Jesus. I mean, you got to admit that's kind of impressive. And then you got Judas who's going, yeah, but who did Jesus put in charge of his own money? He made me the treasurer, so that means he probably trusts me the most. And then you got Peter, who's just kind of standing over there in the corner, just kind of waiting, you know, sitting back, biding his time, waiting for everybody to finish, and he just kind of goes, guys, I walked on water. Did any of you guys walk on water? No, I didn't think so. They were arguing about who was the greatest, because their view of greatness was all about, how do I compare to you? Do you ever find yourself comparing? You're at someone's home, and you compare their furniture to your furniture, or maybe their car to your car, or their kitchen to your kitchen. You know, a couple months ago, I went over to a church member's house, and they have these beautiful wooden floors, and their backyard just looks amazing. Got this beautiful back patio, and I'm just sitting there going, I want that. Man, that looks so nice. I wish I could have that at my house. Or maybe, you know, you compare simple things, you know, like your job with someone else's job, or, you know, your phone with someone else's phone. That's a big one. Everybody wants a new phone. You're a parent, and you compare your kids with other people's kids. You know, we do that all the time, like, you know, man, why can't my kids be like that? Or I'm glad my kids aren't like that, right? Or my daughter's applying to Ohio State. What about your daughter? Oh, just a county college. I heard that it's very nice, you know. Or you're a pastor, and you say, why are so many people going to that church and they're not coming to my church? We have this habit of measuring our success by comparing it with other people's success. We get our sense of strength from people's relative weakness. C.S. Lewis said it so well. Listen to this. Pride is essentially competitive. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good looking, but they aren't. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. Guys, this is human nature. And by the way, did you notice how the other 10 disciples responded when they heard what James and John had requested? When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Righteous indignation. You know, how could you? You know why they were really so mad? Because they wanted those seats too. So our default way comes out is competition. And then there's another way it comes out. Domination. And this can get ugly. Look at verse 42. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." So Jesus says the rulers of the Gentiles, in other words, the secular people's approach to leadership is to dominate others. You get to tell people what to do, and they have to obey. And you are clearly above them, and they are clearly beneath you. And the disciples of Jesus didn't have to look far to see this taking place. I mean, there were on every street corner, there were Roman soldiers, well-armed Roman soldiers. How about today? Do you ever see people seeking greatness through domination? You see it all the time. I mean, this country's full of it. You can find it in politicians, in school principals, in bosses, in police officers, and parents, and pastors. It's the thinking that says, I will feel good about myself based on the power that I have over you. So Jesus calls his disciples together and he says, listen, we all know that secular leadership works through domination. Why would he bring that up? Well, because James and John, when he heard their request, he realized they actually had no problem with the concept of domination. They just wanted to be the ones dominating. They hoped to replace the self-serving, oppressive power structure of the Romans with their own self-serving, oppressive power structure. Nothing changes except the names of the rulers. Oppressive power gets recycled and new tyrants will rise on the scene. The worldly ambition to be at the top and to beat down others still rules. Guys, James and John are a lot like us. When we think about leadership, when we think about being successful and what we want in life, our natural way is to approach it with competition and domination. And frankly, that's one of the biggest reasons why we're often so miserable. I heard a great quote this past week. The secret of every discord in Christian homes and communities and churches is that we seek our own way and our own glory. Think about that. The reasons there is discord or tension or stress in your home, or in your marriage, or in your business, or in our church, is because we are all James and John, trying to compete and dominate, some of us more aggressively and some of us a little more passively, but it always is going to end badly. And I think that one of the most important lines in this whole passage comes in verse 43. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Jesus says, you know that's the way the world works, but not so with you. Because you're my followers and we do things different. Guys, if we are really followers of Jesus, then the way we handle power and leadership needs to be totally different from the way that the world does it. And that leads to point number two, the better way. James and John thought that the path to success was through competition and domination, and Jesus gives this radically different approach. He says, no, actually, it's not. The best kind of life and the best kind of leadership come through suffering and service. You said, what? What are you talking about? That doesn't sound appealing at all. I know, but just stick with me here. First, let's talk about suffering, all right? Right after the sons of thunder made their big request, here's what Jesus said. You don't know what you're asking. Jesus said, can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? Now remember when Jesus was praying in the garden right before his arrest and he said, Father, if it's possible, take this what? Take this cup from me. So the cup is symbolic of suffering and baptism has the same meaning in this context. So Jesus is saying, you guys are asking for prominent positions in my kingdom, but those positions don't just get handed out. They always come through suffering. Sometimes we seek a high position because we like the prestige and the honor that come with that role. But just like James and John, we don't really know what we're asking. So we have no clue of the pain and the sacrifice that accompany leadership. Because here's what I found. When you're in a leadership role, whether it's a pastor or a manager or a parent, any leadership role, if you're doing it well, then it comes with suffering. Because you're making hard decisions that affect people's lives. You're being regularly criticized. You feel the pressure of people's expectations. Leadership, in many ways, is painful. It comes with the territory. So let me ask you something, parent, boss, teacher, manager, spiritual leader. Are you experiencing any pain in your leadership? Any pressure? Any stress? Any sacrifices? And don't be surprised if you do. And don't let it scare you away. That's the part that's part of the cup that we drink as leaders. Listen to what Paul says in Colossians 1:24. Now I rejoice in what I am suffering for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions, for the sake of his body, which is the church. Now notice two things about that passage. First, the purpose of his sufferings. He says, I'm suffering for you. And then he says, I'm suffering for the sake of his body, which is the church. So when we suffer as leaders, it's not just pain for the sake of pain. It's always done for the sake of others. Just like the sufferings of Jesus were for our good, we as leaders suffer for the good of people we're called to lead. So never forget that purpose. And because of that, here's the second thing. Paul says, I rejoice in what I'm suffering. When you're staying up half the night to take care of a sick child, when you're coming in early to your classroom to help give extra help to your students, when you're sitting in the hospital with a family member or just a friend whose loved one is in the ICU, those are all acts of leadership that involve sacrifice and pain. But you can rejoice in that, because you know that it's for the good of others. So this countercultural vision of greatness that Jesus gives is not an easy life. It involves suffering, and then secondly, it involves service. So Jesus says, you know all about secular leadership. It's about lording your position over people and dominating them, but not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave to all. In other words, if you really want to be great, stop viewing people as a means to an end. And start viewing them as precious people to be served. Service is putting another person's needs ahead of your own and making sacrifices for the good of that person. And isn't it interesting that we remember the people who serve us? Some of the most impactful moments that I've had in my life have come when I was serving others, expecting nothing in return. So sometimes that's what service looks like. Maybe it's counseling your coworker, washing the dishes for your spouse, taking your elderly father to the hospital. It's like when Jesus washed the feet of his disciples, right? Giving up your rights, giving up your convenience to meet the needs of others. And you know what? Even though there's some suffering in that service, I think it's actually kind of rewarding. Because people usually appreciate what you're doing for them. But sometimes serving isn't so rewarding. At least not in the short term. For example, you walk into the bedroom of your child, and it's strewn with half-eaten bowls of cereal or ramen noodles or empty soda cans. What does it mean then to serve your child? Does it mean that you clean the room up for them? Because that would be the easy thing, right? And you might even feel like noble, you know, like, oh, I'm coming around. Look at me. I'm sacrificing, you know. I'm sacrificing and cleaning up my child's room. And I'm so Christ-like. But actually, in that moment, serving them, what would that look like in that moment? What would it be? Making them clean the room. And so you're actually sacrificing their short-term approval, right? And that's part of the pain of leadership. You're doing something that doesn't make you very popular. You're truly serving their needs. They may not like you for it. So when you think of service, make sure you don't have a narrow definition of what that means. It means sacrificing your convenience for the good of others, and that takes a lot of different forms. Jesus says to his disciples, whoever wants to be great, in other words, he doesn't rebuke them for wanting to be great. He rebukes them for the way that they wanted to achieve greatness. They thought it came through competition and domination. Jesus said, no, it's through suffering and service, and it's really a paradox. Because suffering and service seem like failure. Suffering and service seem like the roles of a slave, not a leader. But Jesus says, nope, that's the path to greatness. So how do we align ourselves with the way of Jesus? I don't know if they put the... So it's not up there yet. Let me just kind of sidestep here for a moment because I was thinking about this over the week after I turned in my slides. Last week I asked you a question. I said, where or how are you serving God right now in this church? Or are you just here to be served? And the truth is, many of you don't serve here at this church. And yet, things still get done. And ministries that we do, they still manage to limp along. Have you ever stopped to ask why that is? And I don't mean like, how do those ministries still happen? That's easy. We have some very dedicated members here that love this church, and they love the Lord, and they serve, and they understand what it means to serve. Let me rephrase that question. Why is it that many of you don't serve here at this church? And I wrestled with that all week. It could be that you're oblivious to the service opportunities around the church. Maybe it's just not something you've ever really thought about. And if that's the case, don't worry. You'll get the opportunity soon. Is it because you think that service is just coming to Sunday morning service? Is that your idea of service? Well, given the context of today's message, I think we can clearly see that that's wrong. Is it because you're too busy with work or family or the club that your kids are in that you just don't have the time to serve? That's a tough one. I mean, we're all at different places there. But the idea is that you're growing closer and closer and closer to Christ, and you're becoming more and more and more like Him. Then your priorities should begin to change, but if they don't, I think that's a clear indication of a lack of growth. You're not producing fruit. And let me just tell you, just like any relationship, if you see your friend maybe once a week for maybe an hour, I don't know, maybe two, are you even really friends with that person? How are you supposed to grow that relationship? You can't. Because relationships take effort. Are you putting effort into becoming more like Jesus and helping serve alongside your brothers and sisters in Christ here at Barberton First Church of Christ? Or maybe you see a service opportunity and you're just like, that's no big deal. Somebody else can do that. Let me tell you, that's exactly how nothing gets done. Or the even worse version of that. That's just not a big enough opportunity. I won't get enough recognition for that. And don't kid yourself. We have people here like that. That's not serving. That is self-serving. And finally, some of you are just indifferent. You could care less. And I don't think I really need to elaborate on that. That's pretty self-explanatory. And that leads me into my final point. Changing our way. The key is really in verse 45, and this is a verse that you should memorize if you haven't already. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many. It's actually really simple. The key to change is to focus on Jesus. Keep your eyes on Him. And that works in two ways. First, His example. Because we become like the people that we idolize and admire, right? And Jesus says, I'm not just telling you to do this. I'm not just issuing commands from my throne. I'm saying, follow my example. Even I didn't come here so that people could serve me. I came to serve them. And you see that service through His whole life. When He allowed Himself to be interrupted while He was teaching, or when He washed feet, or most awesomely at the cross. So the example of Jesus inspires us, but it also gives us empowerment. When trusting Christ, there's this spiritual thing that happens within us. His life actually begins to flow through us, and we really start to become like Christ. And we find ourselves doing things that we could never do on our own. So when you're driving to work in the morning, when you're driving home to be with your family, or when you're walking to class, pray something like this. Lord, I know that I have this tendency to promote myself and to be competitive, but I'm praying for the power of Christ to fill me and flow through me and make me a servant. And if you'll do that, it'll be more and more visible to everyone around you. You won't need a t-shirt that says Jesus is our magic for people to know. They will be able to clearly see that through your servant attitude. Because this kind of leadership that we're talking about does not come naturally. It comes through the power of Christ. That's what you need to pull it off. So as we close, let me suggest three really practical ways to live this out. Number one, rethink the purpose of your position. Do you remember the movie Braveheart? I think I talked about it earlier this year. I showed a clip from it during the Nehemiah series. Mel Gibson, he plays this character named William Wallace, who actually was a real person. This is all based on a true story. Who was fighting for the independence of Scotland from England. And he's talking with one of the Scottish nobles. They were Scottish men, but they were sort of like puppets from the English government, you know. And they had these very comfortable positions. So William Wallace says to this noble, he says, "You think the people of this country exist to provide you with position. But I think your position exists to provide those people with freedom." That's a powerful statement. And this applies no matter what position of leadership you have. Like Jesus said, you're not there to be served, you're there to serve. And I think we see this the most played out as restaurant managers, you know. I love going to a restaurant, whether it's fast food or even a little more upscale, and seeing the managers come around and offer to get things for you. You know, there's this one restaurant, we don't go there often because it's kind of expensive, but I guarantee if you were to go there, the manager will at some point come up to your table and they will ask you, and they genuinely mean it, "Did you enjoy your meal? Is there anything I can get you? Can I get you a glass of water? Can I get what can I refill your drink?" You know, and what they're doing by doing that is they're showing their employees that they are not above serving. They'll wash the dishes with their employees. They will mop the floors. They're letting them follow in their example, and I think that's the best demonstration that we can come up with. The even better one should be the church, but oftentimes it's not. So the second way is show genuine interest in others. Look with me at Philippians 2, 3 through 4. Before we read it, I want you to think about whatever position that you have of leadership, whether it's a grandparent or a father or a mother or a teacher or a boss, whatever it is, all right? So you got that? Okay, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. One of the things that I've noticed lately is that you have some people who always have their cell phone in their hand, which speaks volumes in and of itself. But they're constantly waiting for that text, or they're constantly waiting for that response to their Instagram post, or that response to that email or that phone call. You know what kind of message that sends? Whatever this person needs is more important than what you need. That's the message that sends. About a year ago, I read this book, and I began making one of these things a habit. It was just a wonderful idea in this book. You know, so now when I sit down with people at a table, what I'll do, it's uncomfortable for me to sit down with my phone in my pocket. You know, so what I'll do is I'll put my phone on vibrate, and I'll put it face down on the table. When I'm talking with people and I'm standing up, my phone is usually in my pocket. Why? Serving people means first and foremost that when you're with them, you're fully present with them. You've put away your phone. You're focused on them, and you truly listen to what they have to say to you. What's important to them becomes important to you. All right, third is become a giver. Adam Grant is a researcher at the Wharton School of Business, and in his research, he identified three basic kinds of workers. There's takers, there's matchers, and there's givers, all right? And this is so pertinent to Jesus' teachings. Takers view the workplace as very competitive. You know, like, if I don't look out for myself first, then nobody will, right? And then you've got matchers who believe that everything works by kind of exchanging favors, you know? So I might do something for you because I'm thinking you might do a favor for me. And then there's givers, and they choose to focus on the needs of others without worrying about what they're going to get back. So takers, matchers, and givers. You know what percentage of people function as givers in their job, in the workplace? Not very many. He says only about 8%. Because most people just assume that if you're a giver, you're being too nice and you'll never get anywhere in your career. And he also says for most people, when they're stressed out at work, their first instinct is to sort of revert to this taker mentality. But here's the aha, the big reveal. In his research, it consistently showed that givers are among the most successful people in business. And very often, they're the happiest. I bet for many of you, as you look back on your career, you were blessed by a giver. Some older person in the organization who took the time to help you. It's a beautiful thing when it happens, but I think it's especially applicable to the church. And now, maybe it's time for you to be a giver. And I don't know what that means for you, but in some way, get up and give your time and your energy to the success of others. It's so rewarding to be a giver. In the eyes of the world, greatness is all about competition and domination, promoting yourself, grabbing the best seats. And James and John and the disciples of Jesus had fallen into that way of thinking. If you and I were really honest, we'd admit we can be a lot like James and John. And Jesus looks at all of us and he says, "Not so with you. Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave to all." It's a paradox, but it's true. Where in this church can you become a giver? In order for us to truly show this city that Jesus is our magic, we all must become givers. In some way, we all need to serve. Where will you serve? Would you stand with me as we close? If you are here today, and maybe today's the day that you want to make Jesus the Lord of your life, we want to offer you that opportunity. Or if you're ready to place your membership here with us today, again, we'd love to have you. Would you close with me as we, would you pray with me as we close? Dear God, Lord, we're so grateful for this place that we have to come together and worship you and listen to your word. And Lord, I just pray that as we go about our weeks, that the Holy Spirit would convict us to find a place to serve. Find someone to serve, to show the example that Jesus gave us. That we're following in the footsteps of him, to truly understand what it means to take up your cross. It's all about being a servant. We love you so much, Lord. In Jesus' name I pray.